Accession number 29234, reel number 4.
Jill Monk, reel 4. You were telling me about hideouts.
Oh, yes. Hideouts. Well, this Scottish gentleman said, oh, actually, that old mare is looking for a home, because they've got the daughter, and so they want to find a home for mother because she's surplus to requirements. So I got the name and address and wrote and said I had a half-bred Irish draft and I was unable to ride it at the time because I was having terrible trouble with my back. And I thought it'd be rather fun to have a Highland pony to breed from, which my niece in Devon, who breeds them, had been pushing me and saying, you don't have those great lumping Irish drafts. You know, you ought to have a Highland pony. So anyway, the long and short of it was that they came over to have a look and took the Irish draft in exchange. So I took her over to their place in Suffolk and came back with Shona. And we became quite friendly. I'd known Colonel Crisp's mother when she used to breed and show Welsh riding ponies. And so there was a sort of connection, you know. And I went over there, when I was over there having lunch one day, because they'd got Red Pole cattle. They'd been instrumental in really popularising a Red Pole again, and I got a lovely herd, and I used to milk sometimes during the war if somebody, a certain farm where they had Red Poles, if they were stuck, you know, I'd go and manage to help out. I couldn't, they were awfully hard milkers, but I could manage, you know, to do a few to help out. And he was, we were talking about the auxiliaries, and I was saying, you know, they, my husband had been in the bombing squad, and he was asking me, as you have, you know, about the auxiliaries and what we did, and he said, now then, some of the land I've just taken over, we found an underground hideout of some sort. Looks like two Nissen huts buried. So I said, oh. I said, do you mind if I give your telephone number to a friend of mine, John Warwicker? Because I know that they are hunting for one of these hideouts in this area, and they haven't been able to find it. So I put them in touch with each other, and sure enough, it was the one they were looking for. And I think they've closed it off, you know, now because it's getting unsafe. I suppose in time the corrugated iron has rusted away, probably. But anyway, it was interesting that, you know.
Did you see it yourself?
No, I've never seen it. No, I always wanted to, but I've never seen it.
But it was two Nissen huts, he thought.
That's how he described it to me. He said it looked like two Nissen huts buried underground. But
there must be quite a few in this area, I would think.
Oh, I imagine there were.
Yes,
but
yes.
We never knew. Mm. I didn't know until after I was married, you see, that such things existed.
Did you find out also other people that were involved that you surprised you? Later on?
No. No, I remember there was a gentleman down in the West Country whose son took over from Colonel Collings when he went on, because when I had Mark, I discovered that John wasn't on a course at all. He'd been dropped in occupied France to soften up, you know, the murky, to tell them what they wanted put out of action in the way railway lines and such like, because he was trilingual. He was born in Paris, and he spoke fluent French and German.
So he would have been SOE, would he?
And, well, who knows? I mean, as far as we knew, he was in his killing Dragoon Guards, and that was it. And he was supposed to come and pick Mark up, and he didn't come for a long while after he was supposed to come, didn't hear anything from him. And then there was a phone message from his batman who said, oh, I've got to come and pick Mark up. I said, oh, is the colonel not coming? Oh, no, he's very sorry. He's too busy to get away. He was stationed at Spilsby in Lincolnshire. So the batman duly came. And I said, oh, sorry the colonel couldn't come. You know, I thought perhaps he'd make the effort to come over and have another ride. Oh, he said he couldn't ride at the moment. He's got lumbago and he isn't half making a fuss about it. It was years later I discovered, actually, he'd nearly been caught by the Germans picking up the Lysander to bring him home. And I think he'd been in a fairly bad shape when they got him back. But it was comparatively recently I found out about that.
And did Mark, you mentioned earlier he was a famous dog.
Yes.
So did he go to France?
No, he was with me. But he went with him on the invasion.
Oh, did he?
And he was with him, yes. He was used for ammunition carrying. He had two leather pouches, like panniers. And he also was used to swim across rivers with a rope so they could get a bridge across.
So he was a...
He was a marvellous dog. Mm-hmm. Apparently, I only knew this in the last 2 or 3 years, that he was... I knew he'd been wounded before Dunkirk, but he was wounded again during the invasion. And this chap said he lost a leg, the dog did. And he was used, because John was over there with the BAOR. He said, you know, it was really horrible having to... punish people for pinching a bit of food or something, you know, some old woman who was starving. But he did, they put on shows, which funnily enough I'm finding out with the book that I'm reading now, they put on shows for the German people, and they did a little pantomime, a sort of Red Riding Hood thing, where Mark rescued the girl from the brutal German soldier, you see. And then after the show, Mark went round with his ammunition pouches for the troops to put money in to buy things for the German people. But when he died, he was buried in the garden of a house. I thought it was in Hamburg, but I couldn't be certain. But the German people put up a little statue of an Alsatian dog, and the inscription on the stone that it stood on was "Mark, a true friend," in German.
That's a very interesting story. We have an exhibition at the museum.
Yes.
On animals at war. And this would really be a very interesting story.
Yes.
For that.
He was a wonderful dog, because he, during the retreat in France, the chaps that John was with were able to sleep and get some sleep at night, because Mark was always on guard. And the colonel in charge got wind of this, and so he thought he'd catch them out. He didn't realise about Mark, but he knew that they were having a kip when they should have been on guard. So he crawled up a ditch nearby where they were parked. And unfortunately, Mark got at him and took the seat out of his breeches, not to mention a certain amount of the colonel.
Well, no wonder you enjoyed having him.
Oh, yes, he was a gorgeous dog, he really was. Mm. I've always longed to have an Alsatian since, but the British Alsatians are such wet things, and they've bred them with their hind legs bent so that when you see them standing, their head is here and their bottom is somewhere down here with these terribly bent hind legs. And I've always thought the temperaments were peculiar, and it's just coming out quite recently that the army and the police are having to buy foreign dogs because the British Alsatian is so effete, they're being bred for show, that they're no use. When they were using them, they'd have, for argument's sake, a litter of 7 pups, and they might get one through. The rest were rejects. They were no good.
Because the Germans used them a lot in the war.
Yes.
The SS.
Yeah.
They were very fierce.
He actually came from Belgium. Mark, he was a Belgian dog. He was huge. He was the size of a Shetland pony. He was a great big dog. He stood... He stood about that height.
That's at least over 3 feet, isn't it?
Mm. He wasn't a dog to tamper with.
Going back to your duties again, am I right that you had set exercises when you were a messenger? That, you would...
Well, every now and again, the troops would have... There would be a troop exercise with all the local troops and RAF regiment, all on the alert for an imaginary invasion.
And were you involved in any way with that? Were you watching and recording that?
Well, we knew that at one point our set was supposed to have been knocked out. And so we had to go to... I had to go out to Hempstead. That was when the man came and smoked his pipe. And I went cross-country out to Hempstead and tied the horse up on the gate a little way away and, sort of hid him. Hid him in the woods, you see, and then went further down.
That must have been very frightening to be in the woods with a man. And the horse, was the horse quiet?
Yes, he was very peaceful, And he'd had a good long ride beforehand, he was glad of a rest.
Would you have been mounted, or did you get off the horse?
I got off him and tied him up well away from where I... There was another gate further up from the gate where I went in, or over, and I took him into the wood and tied him up in the wood. And then I went down to the other gate and went in to find the drop place.
The message in the tennis ball.
Yes.
Yes. I was also going to ask you about the cones. Have you any idea what sort of system was used? Did you use full words, or were the letters mixed up?
I think it was the letters, because we had to send messages rather like a text message now, Very, very shortened.
Yes, so it would have been a sort of shortened word.
Yes.
Yes. But the code part would have been the arrangement, would it, of the...
Of the letters, yes.
Yes, I see, yeah. Was that fairly easy for you to grasp and do, at the technical part?
Yes, as long as you didn't get disturbed. Because the trouble with the doctor's house, you'd get the phone going and have to go and take a message. That was the only annoyance. Then you'd lose track of what you'd done. You know.
Yes, and did you have to be very careful about concealment every time? You know, having had your asbestos...
Well, we hadn't had any... We hadn't any staff in the house then.
So you could actually just leave it, could you?
Well, no, it was put away out of sight. Mum had a big black bureau in the dining room. We had this wonderful great refectory table that Dad had designed with the stretcher underneath. Instead of the straight one that you've got your feet stuck on, it was a Y shape at each end and the plank went down the middle. So you didn't get stuck trying to get close to the table. And we used to spread the codes out on the table and do them. But they were kept in Mum's bureau in one of the drawers. All the sheets.
So your mother was involved throughout the war like your father?
Yes, she was. Well, when we got the radio set, she was drawn in because she had more time, or supposed to have more time, to do the decoding and the coding up.
How about this gardener? How did you deal with him, who was rather, your gardener, who was rather suspicious?
Oh, well, he was not exactly morose, but he was typical Norfolk, but he didn't talk unless he was spoken to, and he didn't use two words if one would do.
So he was ideal?
Absolutely ideal. And because he was TB, nobody would go near him. You know, the family and everybody kept away from him. I don't know whether he actually lived alone or whether he had a mother who kept house for him, but it did eventually catch up with him, unfortunately, and he went, got him in his brain.
Were any of you paid for doing this work?
Good Lord, no.
Or expenses? Any expenses?
No.
Or extras?
No. No, good heavens, no. It'd been insulted if it'd been offered.
Is that so? You were doing it as a duty?
No, it wasn't a duty. It was something we wanted to do. We were volunteers. I mean, we felt it was something that we could do, you know. We weren't able to fight, so it was the next best thing.
You did your bit.
Yeah.
Did you get any recognition for this at any time?
No.
Not a medal, a defence medal?
They said that I wasn't doing it for long enough, and they had no record of Dad. So I couldn't even get his posthumously.
I suppose by the very nature, they might not have had
Well, John Warwicker a few years back came over to see me and he said, "You told me your father was in the Home Guard." I said, "Yes, he had a major's uniform and he was battalion MO to all the Home Guards around." Well, he said, "I can tell you something, he wasn't in the Home Guard." I said, "I hate to have to mention it, but he was." He said, "Here are the lists of all the Norfolk Home Guard groups, battalions, or whatever they were." He said, "Your father's name is not on any of them." So I said, "Well, that's peculiar." But I said, I've seen the uniform, seen him going out in it. So then he said, "Well, these were all printed lists." He said, "I've got a handwritten list of about 12 names. And the last one on the list was either A.G. or R.G. Holman. Now, an old-fashioned A can look a bit like an R. And I think that was Dad. I said, that was Dad, because he was A.G. Holman. He said, well, these were the chaps who were auxiliaries using the Home Guard as a cover. And that was why Dad would never parade in uniform when they had sort of Wings for Victory and, you know, all the rest, all these sort of parades of all the Red Cross and the Brownies and the Scouts and one thing and another. You know. He always went in civvies.
And was he operational throughout the war, your father?
Well, I know he was one of the prime movers with the Home Guard to start with, when they were the LGV.
But do you know when the set went? Did you have any idea when your set was taken, as you say, to be dumped in a coal mine?
Well, I wasn't there then, no. Because my sister came home because she was having a baby. And because I asked her, that's why I asked her about the codes, but she had so little to do with it that she'd had to sign the Official Secrets Act, but she had so little to do with it that she didn't really remember anything except the chap who took over from John was known as the Chocolate Soldier, because he was always bringing them bars of chocolate.
Be welcome, I imagine. Your brother, what happened to your brother?
Well, when the health service came in, Dad was not a bit happy. He said, I'm a civil servant. And he said, I'm not bred to be a civil servant. I'm not the right mentality. He was like me, he was independent. He said, I can't treat my patients as numbers. He said, my patients have always been my friends. And he said, I can't do it, it's no good. And so he retired early, which of course meant he had a much less pension. I think he retired about 3 years early. And I suppose pretty straitened circumstances, because, I mean, in the old days they sold their practice and their house and the surgery, and that was their retirement money. Well, the money that he got for the practice was peanuts compared with what it really was worth. He'd had to do a scheme during the war when another doctor in the town decided that he came from a military family and so he should be the one to do something for the war effort. It's rather stuck in Dad's craw, especially as the military family consisted of a father who was in the old Volunteers. Anyway, he disappeared. And Dad said he would look after his patients. Dad and his partner had $1,500 apiece. This chap had barely $500. He said, I'll look after them and I'll guarantee to hand them back to you after the war. Oh no, that wasn't good enough. There was a scheme which the government dreamed up called the Protection of Practices Scheme, in which they were paid too little to cover the cost of any medicines they had to dole out, let alone their calls or their surgery time, you know. And no patients must leave the previous practice for 3 years after the war, or after the other doctor coming back. Well, of course, the trouble was that shoals of them wanted to leave, and Dad and Cecil had to say, no, we can't, you know, we can't take you on. And they were very offended, a lot of them who were related to patients who already were, you know, part of Dad's practice. And it did make a very difficult situation. And it meant that, of course, Dad's practice was out of pocket for every one of them. But he said, oh, well, it's the war, you know.
And your brother, what happened to your brother?
He was up at Cambridge studying medicine. And he was having to work very hard because he hadn't actually got the right subjects. He hadn't done, he had to do the first 2 years anyway that normally they would have done at school. And he'd been slogging his guts out and he got pneumonia. When he came home and tried to get fit while he was, you know, during the very long vac. And he'd go and skip like mad till he was absolutely out of breath, you know, and then go and sit around and get chilled. And he got pneumonia and was very ill. Got round from that and went for his medical for the forces, because in Cambridge they were being handed out white feathers, you know. He said he couldn't take it.
Is that so? Did he tell you that?
Yes. And, you know, if they went to take a girl out, or the other girl, any girl students, which were very few and far between, you know, why aren't you fighting? Anyway, he was failed his medical, and he was told to go off and do a job for 6 months out of doors. And so he went and worked for the Forestry Commission down near Woodbridge. And from having got terribly fat with taking no exercise while he was at Cambridge, he became the old Paddy again and went back to Cambridge. But he had done enough by then to have been able to finish his course, his degree, and then go into the forces as a doctor, which was silly really, but he said no. His tutor assured him that his scholarship and exhibition would be carried on when he came back from the services. And so off he went, joined the Air Force, and he became a navigator. And he said, to tie up with a pilot, you had to stand around rather like a girl at a dance, waiting for somebody to ask you to dance, you know. And he said, I was very lucky. I got the top chap of the course as my pilot. As Paddy was very, very methodical. And he would actually have made a wonderful scientist, I think. You know, absent-minded professor wasn't in it. And they were on bow fighters. And they were hanging about training in this country and kept, you know, demanding, I think, a friend of Paddy's he'd been at school with,